Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we're continuing our theme on social justice and community activism. On today's program, we're joined by Medea Benjamin of Code Pink to discuss the importance of community activism working towards social justice. And we're joined by longtime nuclear energy expert and whistleblower Arnie Gunderson about ongoing concerns of radioactive contamination from Fukushima 5 years later. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we continue our theme on social justice and community activism for the second annual Social Justice Week at Sonoma State University in Northern California. On today's show, we have two wonderful guests. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Arnie Gunderson about ongoing concerns of radioactive contamination in Fukushima. But first, we are joined by activist Medea Benjamin of Code Pink to discuss the importance of community activism working toward social justice. And here is Peter to introduce Medea to you. Peter?
Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of the women's-led peace group Code Pink. She's also co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. Medea has authored 8 books, including Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, and she's been an advocate for social justice for over 40 years. Medea, welcome.
Thank you so much, Peter and Mickey.
You're a keynote speaker for the Social Justice Week at Sonoma State University, and our theme is the importance of community activism and social justice at a grassroots level. Could you talk a little bit about what that means in your life?
Well, I guess it means when you see what's happening in the world, you don't just turn your head and go on and do something that has nothing to do with the world's problems, but you pick some of them and work on them. I often liken it to just reading the newspaper and not being so cynical as saying, oh, another hospital blown up here, another war going on here, another water system that has been toxic for people there, but that you really do get upset about these things and you join and start working on ones that really speak to you.
You've been involved in protest actions around labor rights, corporate responsibility, Israel, Palestine, Iraq, drones. What is your primary activity right now?
I'm working now on what I consider one of the elephants in the room around foreign policy, and that's Saudi Arabia. Here, the U.S. is involved in all kinds of wars in the Middle East that most Americans can't even figure out because it is indeed very complicated. And they know we have this ally, Israel, that somehow people have been convinced to think is a democratic country. And then there is Saudi Arabia, the greatest U.S. Arab ally in the region that we have been allied with since its founding in 1932. 12 presidents, Democratic and Republican, have all kept up this relationship, and it's just a disaster. It's a disaster because it's one of the most repressive regimes in the world towards its own people, and it's a disaster because the Saudis are spreading the very extremism that we say we're trying to counter. So that's what I'm focusing on right now, is how do we really build the movement to challenge the U.S.-Saudi relationship?
Medea Benjamin, do you see any headway on that? You just gave a quick snapshot of the history of sort of the problem there about how the U.S. allies in the region, particularly with Saudi Arabia, which is quite troublesome. Are you seeing any headway when you're going around and speaking? Are you seeing any cracks in that kind of alliance? What is your view on that as far as where we're heading?
Give us a little time, Mickey, since we just started about 2 weeks ago.
Right. Well, yeah, you're up against a big timeline there as far as decades and decades of that go. But this is certainly a heartening endeavor.
But it's a good time to do it because so many things are changing in the region and internally. The U.S. used to be very dependent on Saudi Arabia for oil. Now we only get 10% of our oil from Saudi Arabia. which does have its negative flip side because they've made their imported oil so cheap that they've destroyed a lot of the fracking industry, which is a good thing. But anyway, that's a complication we could get into. So we're not dependent on them for oil anymore. Perhaps more dependent is on weapon sales. They are the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons, massive amounts of weapons. In fact, since 2010, the deals go into almost $100 billion worth of weapons. And unfortunately, the U.S. media has not been covering the Saudi war in Yemen, where bombings are occurring every single day with U.S. weapons that are destroying hospitals and marketplaces. In fact, a marketplace was hit and over 140 people died. We are directly related to what's going on there. In fact, there's even U.S. cluster bombs, weapons that the international community has banned, that are being produced in this country, sold to the Saudis, and killing Yemenis. There's a lot of things that we have to focus on. We're teaming up with people in Europe who are starting to not only build, but actually have some success in banning weapon sales to Saudi Arabia from their countries. And we're starting to make some inroads with at least getting some members of Congress to start speaking out about this. So it's an important time to focus on Saudi Arabia. And I think if you talk to us a year from now, we'll hopefully have some successes in at least more distance between the U.S. and the Saudis.
Well, we'll certainly do that, Medea Benjamin, as follow-up just even throughout this year. But this is also not just a heartening endeavor, but a timely one, as there are certainly problems and some discontent within Saudi Arabia. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's hard to gauge how much because the government is so repressive. Even people who write blogs are sentenced to 15 years in prison and 1,000 lashes, like the case of Raif Badawi. People are not allowed freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, no political parties. The lawyers defending any of the dissidents are themselves arrested and put on trial and put away. They recently executed 47 people in the beginning of this year, among them a very prominent member of the Shia community, which is a minority religious community in Saudi Arabia, a peaceful dissenter. And there are three people who were arrested when they were juveniles, 15 and 17 years old, who are on death row in Saudi Arabia for peaceful dissent. They're also members of the Shia community. They've been sentenced to execution by beheading and then crucifixion, meaning their bodies would be put up on a pole for several days for the public to view. I mean, this is really a regime that is quite disgusting, and it's shameful that the U.S. considers this country an ally. But this issue about dissent, we do know that certainly in the Shia community, which is 10 to 15% of the population, there is a lot of discontent. And we know through the internet, because that's one of the only spaces that people have available, where people can talk even anonymously to each other, that the lowering of the price of oil has caused an economic crisis. The government has had to cut all kinds of subsidies to the population, and this is increasing the discontent internally. So, yes, there's a lot of turmoil that we don't hear or necessarily even see, but it's happening.
The Saudi cutting of oil has been linked to the U.S. desire to undermine both Venezuela and Russia in terms of oil prices and weaken those governments, and at the same time increase weapon sales to the Saudis and their involvement in Yemen. It's a wild theater of war and lies. I mean, certainly the U.S. is saying that human rights is the number one concern of building democracy, yet we're in bed literally with this despot, a monarchy, who's been funding a major part of what's going on in Syria.
Well, that's right. And I just spoke to Larry Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff for Colin Powell, and he said straight out, the Saudis are funding ISIS. I said, how do you know that? He says, I know it. The Saudis are funding al-Qaeda groups in Syria, and this is not even to go back to the origins of where does the ideology for these extremist groups come from, and it comes from Saudi Wahhabism. So the Saudis are providing the ideological underpinnings for these extremist groups, and they're also providing funding for them. So it is quite a wild configuration when you try to unravel it. But the end result is that the U.S. is in bed with the regime that is causing many of the very problems that we are supposedly fighting.
We're speaking with Medea Benjamin, and we're focusing on the program today on issues of social justice. And Medea Benjamin, you said you spoke with Larry Wilkerson. Who are some other folks that you're talking to as of late that have maybe some other perspectives on what's happening in the region, whether it's Syria, what's going on, certainly in Yemen, but who else are you hearing from that we're certainly not hearing from in the corporate media?
Well, one person you are hearing from is Donald Trump, and he has certainly said some interesting things when it comes to the region. And it does give a sense that a lot of these issues we shouldn't assume are left-right issues. When Donald Trump said that George Bush was a liar and got us into the war in Iraq, which has been a big fat mistake, he got cheers from the people who were in his crowd. This is quite remarkable, but it is interesting, I think, to note that the U.S. policy is a mess in the Middle East, and that the sentiment, while the Republican candidates, and of course there's the hawk of Hillary Clinton, are talking about increased militarization, I really think that is not the sentiment of the American people. But it does mean that we're going to have to rebuild the peace movement that got destroyed during the Obama years and start being much more effective in forcing our government to get us out of these wars.
Medea, talk to us about Code Pink, the numbers of organizations involved, the nature of the, it's pretty grassroots. How would people engage in becoming members of Code Pink or forming their own Code Pink group?
Well, we give a lot of autonomy to the local groups. There's a group in California, for example, that has really taken on the issue of drone warfare, and they do regular protests outside of the Creech Air Force Base, which is located outside of Las Vegas. They have really taken national leadership on this issue because it's out of Creech that the pilots are sitting in their comfortable ergonomic chairs and pressing buttons to kill people thousands of miles away. So that's an example of a local group taking on a campaign that has very broad implications. There's another program we have at Code Pink that's really designed to look at what is the kind of world we want to live in, what we call building the peace economy, and encouraging people to do things very locally that will get them off of the war economy and onto a peace economy, which means everything that is green and sustainable, but also not involved with the weapons industry that is really determining so much of our policies. And I think now at election time, we're part of a very broad-based national movement that's looking at money and politics and is going to have a series of actions in April and coming together to show the connections between so many different movements, whether it's around environmental issues or issues around gun violence in this country or, in our case, the issues around the constant wars, to trace that back to the role of lobbying groups, the role of money in politics, the corruption of our political system. So there's all kinds of different things that people could get involved with at Code Pink, and they can go on to the website codepink.org to look at these different campaigns and join us.
We're speaking with author and longtime social justice activist Medea Benjamin. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will continue our conversation with Medea Benjamin after this short musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we're joined for the first part of our program by Madea Benjamin. We've been talking about social justice issues from global to local, and we want to continue that conversation with Madea Benjamin now. Madea, you, of course, know that earlier in March, you had mentioned drone attacks and drone pilots and so forth. And there was an unprecedented death toll with U.S. drone and airstrikes killed 150 people in Somalia. And, of course, whistleblowers had warned that the drone program is one of the most devastating and driving forces for terrorism and destabilization around the world. There were articles on Common Dreams, Rania Kallik, Glenn Greenwald. Certainly some people were picking up on this and covering it. Greenwald, in particular, had said the 150 people killed in Somalia, the government and the Pentagon claimed not to worry about it, that they're definitely militants. But their definition, of course, is all military-age males in a strike zone. This is typical in terms of the definition of drone strikes, but this is a quite alarming figure. What were your thoughts on that?
Just as Glenn Greenwald pointed out, it's meant to reassure the American public, don't worry your little heads about this. We know what we're doing, and we're killing the bad guys. Well, you know, we should worry our little heads about it because they've been doing this now for a decade. And what have they gotten, which is more extremism, more wars, more al-Qaeda, more ISIS. And I have seen firsthand the results of these drone strikes going to places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen, and seeing the hatred towards Americans that come when a marketplace is bombed or an innocent person's home is bombed or children are killed. And this idea that we can, because we have the ability to, go to places that we're not even at war at, kill people by remote control, and just assume or tell people that they're militants, you know, is the height of imperial arrogance. But when you look at what happens on the ground, it means for every drone strike that we launch, there's 10, 20, perhaps even 100 people who then join a militant movement. And we're just feeding these movements. We're the best recruiting tool. If you look at the case of Yemen, it was the one place where Obama 2 years ago pointed to say, now here's, you know, where we've been doing drone strikes and have a positive result in killing al-Qaeda. Well, look at the mess that Yemen is in today. So, yes, this is a signature policy of the Obama administration using the drone strikes, and it's been disastrous.
It's also the case that some of these drone pilots are suffering PTSD. They're, you know, leaving those posts. They're protesting. They're whistleblowing about what's going on here. And they're now being retaliated against.
Well, that's right. And in some ways, it's showing their humanity that they can't quite compute having a job during the day where you press a button to kill somebody and then go home and are the perfect husband and father and ready to coach the Little League. It means that people are really thinking about the consequences of their work. And it also means that the U.S. is having a very hard time recruiting enough drone pilots. So it definitely has an impact on the people who are doing this work. And fortunately, some of them are coming out to join in the movement and calling for an end to the use of drones.
Madea, for some time we've been involved in research on the transnational corporate class and the concentration of corporate capital worldwide. Talk to us a little bit about your concerns with the WTO, fair trade, and the TPP.
Well, I think as Bernie Sanders has been educating people during this campaign, and to some extent even Donald Trump, these trade agreements have been disastrous for working people, disastrous for the environment, and they've only built the inequalities and strengthened them. I worked from the time of the first agreement of NAFTA and was down with the movement of the Zapatistas who rose up to say no to NAFTA right even before it went into effect, knowing that it would destroy their farms, knowing that they couldn't compete with things like the importation of corn into their country. And sure enough, it threw many, many, many thousands of farmers out of business and fed the big corporate farms in the United States that have been destroying the small farms in this country. So we've seen now for decades the results of these disastrous trade agreements that give all of the advantages to the large corporations. And it's unfortunate that this is something that the Obama administration has been championing, but it has spawned a very strong movement in all of the countries that will be affected. And I think it's a tribute to our movements in the United States that we're able to connect the different sectors of our society that are affected, from unions to folks working around food and farming issues, and that we're connecting to people in the other countries to have joint actions, to have inside-outside actions, to go to the trade meetings, to really strategize. And I think that we can defeat this one.
That's certainly hopeful, given what we've seen in the past with both Republicans and Democrats with neoliberal agendas. And it looks as, of course, the Republicans would naturally continue this. And the Clinton campaign also has a long and reckless history here, whether it was NAFTA or you know, the flip-flopping but ultimate support of what's going on with TPP with Hillary Clinton. Let's turn this neoliberal agenda to what's going on in Latin America, Honduras in particular. There was just a death of a very prominent activist there not too long ago. And then just another, Nelson Garcia, another murder in Honduras. And we're trying to find out more information about this. What is your take on what's happening there and how the U.S. and some of Clinton's work at Secretary of State might be involved or behind this in some part?
Yes, it's great that at least in our left media, there's educating people about the role that Hillary Clinton had played in supporting the coup that was against Mel Zelaya that led to the kind of death squads that have been plaguing Honduras ever since. But unfortunately, we don't hear that in the mainstream media. The death of Berta Cáceres is a tragedy, and the death of her colleague more recently is. And this has unfortunately been going on ever since the coup took place. And the United States, instead of calling a coup, whether it's in Honduras or in Egypt, where there has been a tremendous, horrendous crackdown on people speaking out against the coup, we have been on the wrong sides. And I think when you look back at Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State, you will see that not only did she do things like support the wars and U.S. involvement in overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, but also being supportive of the coup in a place like Honduras. And these things have horrendous consequences, whether you look at Libya today and the kind of chaos that's there, or you look at the death squads that are now plaguing Honduras, or you look at what's happening in Egypt, are direct results of violations of international law that the U.S. should have been speaking out against instead of supporting.
We've seen some new indications of BDS may be having some successes. AHAVA announced they're going to move their factory. I see this on your front page in terms of activities from the West Bank. And G4S just announced that they no longer would provide security for Israeli settlements inside Palestine. BDS has also been attacked in Canada and other places for even being illegal. What successes do you expect in the future?
Well, if any of your listeners don't know what you're referring to, it's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This is a nonviolent way of protesting the Israeli government policies that was launched by Palestinians themselves and taken up by solidarity groups all over the world. I was just speaking to somebody from our friends in France where BDS was actually made illegal. In fact, it is illegal for them to even wear a t-shirt that is supporting BDS. And as a result of this, our friends got a lot of people together and all went out and wore their t-shirts. But it's very scary how the pro-Israeli government people around the world are attacking anybody who's using nonviolent tactics to oppose very violent policies of the Israeli government. And the pro-Israel lobby group AIPAC is an example of a group that has been attacking anybody in the United States and putting the fear of God into the entire Congress to go along with the Israeli government policies. So I'm excited by BDS. You mentioned that there was a campaign that Code Pink has launched and been involved in for the last 7 years to try to get a company that is quite a large cosmetic company called Ahava to either move its factory away from Palestinian lands or close down. And finally, after 7 years, we were successful. So these things are a great way to decide how we want to use our consumer dollars to get involved at a very local level. I mean, there's even the issue of some food co-ops that didn't want to sell Israeli products. And these issues are playing out now in the court and becoming huge venues for discussing why people are opposed to Israeli government policies. So it's a great tactic, and we're having some very important victories.
Well, Medea Benjamin, on U.S. university campuses, you know, we're seeing efforts to try to stifle BDS movements. Nora Barris Friedman did a fantastic book on BDS movements on campuses across the U.S., but we're seeing that really a censorship of social justice activism around these issues. So it's definitely something that people should be alert to, and we should ever be vigilant combating the conflation of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, because that's been the go-to tactic to try to silence any kind of criticism of Israeli policy vis-a-vis Palestine.
Well, very much so, and it's so important to support these student groups that are being attacked, just like any of the community groups that are being attacked. We can't allow the large amounts of money that some of the anti-BDS groups have accumulated and the lawyers that they have working on this to violate our First Amendment rights as Americans to speak out on these issues and decide how we want to use our own consumer dollars or even how our tax dollars should be used. So, yes, these BDS movements are constantly under attack. My organization is under attack, being called anti-Semitic for being involved in the BDS groups. And, you know, on one level, you can laugh at that and say, well, many of us are Jews, but it's not funny. It's serious attacks, and it is important that we not only do this work, but that we, as you said, Mickey, make it clear that being against the policies that are so oppressive as the Israeli government is not anti-Semitic. On the contrary, I would say that Israel is digging its own grave right now if it doesn't stop, and that our work is really in favor of the future of all the peoples who live in that tiny piece of land.
Wow. Medea, how significant, and you mentioned this earlier, that Bernie Sanders was choosing not to speak at AIPAC. How significant is that decision?
I think it's very significant. Anybody who goes to AIPAC really has to grovel. Donald Trump is in a category all his own. But in general, it's been just so sad to see how politicians, members of Congress, elected officials on all levels of government have had to grovel to AIPAC because they have so much influence. They are connected to so many organizations that not only give money to candidates, but also can and have shown their ability to take out elected politicians who don't go along with them. They have put up primary challenges to congresspeople that they don't like, and they have unseated standing congresspeople, and that's very hard to do. So, yes, I think it's important that Bernie Sanders does not go to AIPAC, not speak there. He has not been great on this issue, but certainly better than the others.
Medea Benjamin, we're going to have to wrap up this segment. So thank you so much for your time and also your tireless efforts in support of social justice causes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on the program.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll continue the program with an update on Fukushima 5 years later from Arnie Gunderson. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined now by nuclear energy expert Arnie Gunderson. We're going to talk about ongoing concerns of radioactive contamination from Fukushima 5 years later. Arnie Gunderson is of the organization Fair Winds Energy Education. It's fairwinds.org, fairewinds.org. Gunderson has 45 years of nuclear engineering experience. He was a former senior vice president of a nuclear power corporation turned whistleblower. And this, of course, has sent Arnie Gunderson on quite an interesting trajectory. And he's going to talk to us about his recent trip to Fukushima. Arnie Gunderson, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, it's nice to be back. I love talking with you guys.
Arnie Gunderson, tell us what's going on. You were just in Japan not long ago. What's the scene there? We don't always hear much in the corporate media in the United States. And what we do hear, well, we're not always sure how accurate it is. So what can you tell us?
Yeah, I spent a month there. I had been there for 6 days and then 10 days in 2012, but I spent an entire month there this time. And well, I did some really good science. We're still working through all the data, but took over 100 samples of radioactive material. And now the bottom line is that even if you assume that Tokyo Electric was doing a good job of cleaning up these little villages, the villages are becoming recontaminated. I was up on the roof of the Minnesota town hall, and this is a town of 60,000 people. Girls pedaling to school on their bikes over the drainage ditches that I was measuring and stuff like that. But I'm up on the roof. And they had just the year before installed solar collectors up there. And they had cleaned the roof and painted the roof. So I knew there was no contamination when the solar collectors were installed. So I see this pile of dirt under the solar collectors. And I crawl under and take a sample. And it's one of the hottest radioactive samples we've ever seen. So what that's telling us is that these villages are recontaminating themselves.
That's alarming information, particularly given Japan, the government there, TEPCO, they're trying to move people back into the prefecture.
Yeah. You know, when you're old like me, it probably doesn't matter. But, you know, to see these young kids bike into school, and their risk is 10 times higher than an adult, and girls are actually 20 times higher than an adult. To see a village that's basically been forcefully repopulated, what happens is the government in Japan takes away their money. And they said, well, if we've paid to resettle you, now we're going to take that away. But if you go home, we'll continue the stipend. So they are essentially forcing people back into contaminated areas. And then worse than that, they made the radiation standards 20 times higher than they used to be. It used to be 1 millisievert, and now it's 20 millisieverts is where they'll allow somebody to move back into. And then put that in perspective, that means that 2 people in 1,000 for every year they're there are going to get cancer as a result of that. This is, if you're there for a life, if you try to build your life there like these little kids, you're looking at 50-50 crapshoot.
Arnie Gunderson, certainly the issues in Japan are very serious, and it's an issue of social justice, and our theme today is about social justice. We've just finished up a week of social justice activities at Sonoma State University, over 30 hours of various programming activities. And one of the ideas, of course, is local activism, ongoing in solidarity with other people around social justice issues worldwide. People at the grassroots, how are they dealing with this? How has this impacted their lives?
Yeah, it really is a social justice issue, because the money in this argument is on the banks want their money back. They've continued to fund these nuclear plants even though they've been shut down. The utilities that own the plants want their money back, and they have extraordinary impact on the Diet. The Diet is like Parliament. And the people who the Parliament is supposed to represent are getting screwed in the process. We ran into a bunch of mothers, mainly. Essentially, whatever the men feel, they're quiet about it, but the trust between government and women has totally disintegrated. And the anti-nuclear movement in Japan is run by women, which is a phenomenal, wonderful thing on the planet. But anyway, they are outgunned by money, you know, sometimes 1,000 or 10,000 to one. But that can't stop them. And that's really what's exciting. I think the only thing that's leveled the playing field even a little bit is the internet. You know, the big companies and the moneyed backers can't control the internet. And people like Fairwinds and NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, they were on this trip with me too. We have a chance to be heard by the people. So if social justice has any kind of momentum now, it's because I think people can realize that they're not alone. They make somebody feel that, you know, it's just me and everybody else is a different way of thinking, then they win. But when they realize there's thousands and ten thousands and hundreds of thousands of like-minded people, I think the internet changed the balance on this to a degree.
So, Arne Gundersen, responsibility for Fukushima, is this a nationwide electoral issue in Japan at this point?
I wish it was, but no. Abe, who's the new prime minister, has been elected on an aggressive economic policy, and they pulled out of economic doldrums, and, you know, people are voting their pocketbook. Abe is a man's candidate. The women are still voting against him, but the men seem to vote in mass in favor of him. So it's that, and it's also there's some nationalism in this thing. They're talking about changing their constitution so they can go to war. And again, the women are taking up the cudgel here to fight that. But a lot of the men are more nationalistic. So Abe is running on both those themes. He's not discussing nukes. As a matter of fact, his wife is anti-nuke. But he's running on this, the economy's getting a little better, and we need to be more forceful. Which scares the crap out of me, because they've got so much plutonium in Japan that in a year they could make at least 100, if not more, nuclear bombs if they wanted to.
Well, you know, there's been a rightward shift there, and there's been censorship in the press. There's been chaos surrounding Okinawa, the remilitarization. Some fairly high-profile protests and activism has taken place in Japan around that with Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, certainly many people in Japan. It's good that you're pointing out that many of the women in Japan are the ones sort of at the forefront of these kinds of protests.
Yeah, and, you know, the Abe regime, there's a nuclear tie here. There's the Manju reactor, which is a fast breeder reactor that runs on plutonium. It's been delayed 22 times, and the budget is at least 10 times what it used to be. And there's the Rokosho reprocessing plant. And both of those are, in theory, you know, for the peaceful use of the atom. But in fact, they can churn out an awful lot of plutonium in no time. And I actually think that America wants that as a foil to China. You know, we want to be able to say, look, you know, if we walk away, the Japanese can make all the bombs they want. It's a frightening game of chicken we're playing over there.
Arne, on March 13th, the San Francisco Chronicle had a featured article where they were reviewing the work of Kai Vetter, a UC Berkeley professor of nuclear engineering, where he had been monitoring radiation levels in water. And the overall view of the story was no cause for worry. 5 years after Fukushima meltdown, California coast levels are normal. Were they saying that they had found 50 million becquerels per cubic meter near Japan, and they're only finding 2 or 3 becquerels now here in the California coast, which you considered normal? They didn't talk about the levels of fallout radiation after Fukushima that hit California, and all the EPA monitors were turned off. So we never really got a good reading on that. But they're saying, well, kind of at this point, that's what's happening. Yet just 2 months ago, Dar Jamel wrote in Truthout that these plumes were on their way and scheduled to hit California coast within the next year, and that we would see a rise. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, first off, Berkeley's nuclear program has been in the forefront of the pro-nuclear propaganda for decades, and since Fukushima has been aggressively downplaying the significance of it. So whatever comes out of Berkeley, I just attribute to a very pro-nuclear faculty. In that article, too, they also talked to Ken Buesler at Woods Hole. And Ken was a little more skeptical than the guys at Berkeley. Ken's measuring 1,000 miles offshore, and he's picking up 10 becquerels per cubic meter. And at my point, that's when my alarm bells go off, is 10. So, you know, offshore, you know, when you get right up against the coast, It's probably that 3-4 kind of Becquerel number is not something I condone, but if somebody wanted to go swimming in it, I guess I'd say, well, you know the risk and the benefits, and in your mind you've made that choice. But when you get out 1,000 miles out, it's a different story, and that plume is still coming. You know, the Pacific's a huge place, and to think that a disaster on the opposite side of the world can be detected and begin to contaminate California, I think that's a monumental, shattering conclusion. Radiation knows no borders. The airborne, you were talking about getting hit early on. California, Oregon, and Washington got hit early on. The noble gases, xenon and krypton, over Seattle were 400,000 times, not percent, 400,000 times. That's 40 million percent higher than they were before the disaster. We picked up hot particles in Seattle. The average person was breathing in about 10 hot particles a day in Seattle down to Portland. A little further south, that would it wasn't as bad as that. But we know we've picked up Fukushima radiation in California, too. So there was that spike in March and April and May. And it actually came back around, and we picked it up again in June on sort of like a reflection. The radioactive material went around the world and came back a second time. So this dilution is the solution to pollution is what I think Berkeley believes in. And what you can be sure of is that somebody's going to die from the radiation that's in the Pacific, but you just won't know who it is. And they're counting on that. You know, the nuclear establishment is saying, well, we can smear that out in a broader epidemiological study so that you won't be able to say that, you know, Jimmy Smith, the one who died of the radiation from Fukushima, yeah, he had cancer, but we can't prove it. The nuclear industry counts on that when they say, well, it's only 3 or 4 becquerels off the coast of California.
We're speaking with nuclear energy expert Arne Gundersen. He is chief engineer at Fairwinds, Fairwinds Energy Education. That's fairwinds.org. He is co-author of the best-selling book in Japan, Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. We'll continue our conversation with Arne Gundersen on the Project Censored Show after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our conversation with nuclear energy expert Arne Gundersen. And Arne Gundersen's just back from Fukushima recently on the 5th anniversary of the tragedy there and the disaster there at the Fukushima plant. Arne, we left off. You were talking about the recent articles in the U.S. about UC Berkeley findings and the radiation is not really a problem for people here. But let's do go back to Japan, where it is a problem. You mentioned earlier that there was a recontamination and ongoing radiation into the air. Where is this coming from? What's the recontamination coming from specifically?
You know, when I was out there, you drive down the roads, and there's 30 million one-ton bags of radioactive trash, and they're putting them all over the place. These huge parks, which used to be old rice paddies, filled with 30 million tons of radioactive trash. But that only counts for the individual villages and 20 feet on either side of the road. So every time it rains or every time the wind blows down from the mountains, these areas become recontaminated by the stuff that's just next door. I was at a guy's house, and he had a line in his garden. And TEPCO, Tokyo Electric, cleaned the right side and said, no, the other side is safe. And there literally was a line through his garden. And he just laughed. He says, well, what's going to keep that radiation from that side from going over to this side? I was at a guy's house, and right across this little ravine was another house that was uninhabitable. So TEPCO determined that the land on one side of this ravine was uninhabitable, but he could live where he lived. So, you know, we're living in close proximity to extraordinarily high levels of radiation, and it blows in the wind. It gets picked up on tires. Some of the biggest samples I found were in parking lots. People are driving from one area to the other. They carry the stuff. 7-Eleven, the convenience store, is a big deal in Japan, and I was sampling the radiation, the mats, as you walk into the 7-Eleven. And son of a gun, the mats are loaded with radiation, too. So people are trucking it everywhere. And to find it on the fourth floor of the Minnesota Town Hall tells me it's not just on your feet, it's blowing through the air like dust.
Arne Gunderson, could you remind our listeners that not so long ago, a large number of these radioactive soil bags were swept out to sea, and also there's still water being pumped into the Pacific Ocean that is highly radioactive?
You know, there's three sources of radiation now into the Pacific. Everybody worries about the Fukushima Daiichi site. And, you know, there's three nuclear cores in direct contact with groundwater because the containments are broken and water's flowing in and flowing out. And that groundwater then heads to the Pacific. That's a big source. Then we've got these bags, you know, 30 million bags of radiation that are sitting around. And as it rains, you can actually see the puddles of water, radioactive water, that the trucks are driving through that are spreading it. But the other big source that everybody forgets about is the mountain range down the center of Fukushima Prefecture, the state of Fukushima. The entire mountain range is contaminated. So every time it rains, you know, even if 1 square mile of Fukushima Daiichi site is excluded, you're taking the whole mountainside and running that into the rivers, which goes right out into the Pacific. And I was just appalled at how little has been done in the mountains. We chased a monkey. These mountains have snow monkeys, and we were up to our knees in snow. And we followed a monkey up into the forest and measured his poop. His poop was measuring 50,000 becquerels per kilogram. So he's eating it from the trees. You know, it's all over the place. And there's no way that any nation can clean a mountain range. It's just an incredibly difficult proposition. So the solution over there is to raise the standard. When it used to be 1 millisievert, now it's 20. That's how they pass the risk off on the population so that the owners of these power plants don't have to pay the cost.
That's quite amazing. We now know that Japan has spent 60% more on fossil fuel imports in 2013 than they did in 2010, and that has put their balance of payments with the U.S. reversed it, $270 billion. So they're buying a lot of coal from the U.S. and oil, of course, and it's changed the trade impact, and their electricity has gone up 20% cost. So there's certainly been an economic impact that's been favorable to the U.S. in one sense.
You're right. They have had to, first off, they reduce the need for power by 19%, which is just astronomical. But then on top of that, you know, they did have 50 power plants shut down, so they fired up some old coal plants and continued to keep the lights on. But, you know, it's been 5 years. So they've had 50 nuclear plants shut down for 5 years. The average plant's got 700-800 people. They're all pretty well paid. Let's say $100,000 a person. So you're looking at a payroll cost per plant per year of pushing less than a billion, but pushing the high hundreds of millions of dollars. There's 50 of these plants. So the banks have ponied up something on the order of between 50 and 100 billion to keep these idle plants employed. Boy, you know, $100 billion could build an awful lot of solar collectors. And the Japanese didn't want to do that. They chose to basically fund people to do nothing for 5 years and import all the coal that they wanted. To my mind, they made the wrong choice. They still have a chance to turn it around, but they've squandered away 5 years when they had a lot of political goodwill, where people had made sacrifices and understood that the sacrifices were necessary, and they squandered it away.
Arne Gundersen, there are 23 plants in the U.S. built the same way as the Fukushima plant, and of course we know the history there with General Electric and the U.S. pushing nuclear energy on the Japanese after World War II. You know, Brian Covert did an excellent study on that for one of our books a couple years back. But really, we're looking at more possibilities for disasters in the future here in the United States because of similar issues. And could you highlight, say, Hurricane Sandy, or also, you know, sort of the toxic waste in groundwater and things that are associated with these aging plants?
You know, all of America's plants are aging. The average age of a nuke in America is, I think, 33 years old now. And the average age of an American is less than that. So to think that these, quote, modern technology is older than the average age of an American is pretty darn amazing. There's 23 plants just like Fukushima Daiichi, a bunch of them right near Chicago. And on top of that, the other 60 or so are also aging. But let's look at the ones that are identical. The NRC staff, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff, came up with a decision that they should be able to vent these containments. In other words, when the containment looks like it's about ready to burst, we don't want to lose the containment, so we'll open a valve and we'll vent it. But we'll harden vent it. We'll put it through special filters and special seismic constraints and all this kind of stuff to suck out most, if not all, of the radiation. So that was the staff's decision. And the five commissioners overrode their own staff. So 4,000 people on the staff say, we really need to make these plants safer with hardened vents. And the NRC just overrode their own staff because they knuckled under the pressure, the economic pressure that the nuclear industry was applying through Congress. So Sandy is a perfect example. Sandy hit, and I actually picked it on Democracy Now! The day before. I said, you know, Oyster Creek is in the bullseye here. And son of a gun, Oyster Creek was in a refueling outage like Daiichi Unit 4 when Sandy hit. And they lost all their power. So the fuel pool in the refueling outage does not get its electricity from emergency sources. So they lost the cooling to the fuel pool. Now the fuel pool's starting to heat up and up and up and up and up. So the owner of the plant ran around and lined up some fire trucks and had them connected up to water tanks. And they were just about ready to start pushing in water into the fuel pool when the electricity came back on. So that was, to my mind, that was a near miss. The tide had risen to the point where it was within 6 inches of wiping out the emergency core cooling pumps. Now, that's supposed to happen once every 10,000 or 20,000 years. And it's happened in, you know, it happened in 40 years at Oyster Creek. So, yeah, we've had our near misses, and, you know, everybody just kind of whistles by the graveyard every time they happen.
And change doesn't come quickly, as we all know, Arne Gundersen. So what are your prescriptions about these ongoing threats from nuclear energy?
Well, I think the first thing is we shouldn't build anymore. They just are not economical. You know, let's take all the safety concerns off the table and talk about money. The two new nukes being built, or proposed to be built, one at Hinkley Point in England and one at North Anna in Virginia, are going to cost around 19 cents a kilowatt, and you can get solar for two. Now, you know, do the math here. Nuclear has priced itself out of the market, so we shouldn't be even considering building new ones. But the other thing is, if your readers want to shut down nuclear power, the way to do it is to put a single solar collector on your roof. You don't have to go big time and spend a lot of money, but nuclear plants still make their money at the summer peak, the hottest part of the day, from noon until 4, when the air conditioning loads are the highest. And that's when the demand is highest, and they sell into that demand. If everybody went out and bought a solar collector, it would drop the demand and drop the prices, and the nukes wouldn't make any money. So, you know, let's shut them down economically.
Arnie Gunderson, your website is fairwinds.org, fairewinds.org. People can go there and learn more at your Fairwinds Energy Education site. And could you leave us with any last words here for today's program? We've been focusing on social justice and environmental justice. Anything else you'd like to add on that front?
My impression of what's going on in Japan is the gross inhumanity of the government of Japan toward its people. Time after time, when the choice is to be made, or should the people be protected or should we make a boatload of money, the boatload of money always wins. And I think that's a national and also an international story that you guys need to cover every month.
Well, we're certainly doing our best to keep up with what's going on, Arnie Gunderson, and we appreciate you, Maggie Gunderson, and the Fairwinds organization for trying to keep us up to date on that. And we work with Fukushima Response here and John Bertucci and so many other folks. And it's heartening to know that people are really out there working on the front lines to tell us what's really going on. So thank you for your work, Arnie Gunderson.
All right. Thanks, Mickey. Thanks, Peter.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
That does it for the Project Censored Show today. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer Anthony Fest, our engineers Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 32 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.